Kevin Kelly is perhaps the wisest person I've ever had on this podcast. And I'm sure you've heard of him in some form or the other. He was the founding editor of Wired Magazine. He's written a ton of books. He's famous for an article he wrote. He's famous for many things, but one thing that stands out is an article he wrote called 1,000 True Fans. The idea is that if you had 1,000 true fans of what you do, you could make a living. So no matter what it is you're interested in, whatever it is you're passionate about, if you create content that has 1,000 true fans, you will make a good living, and that's all you need. Better to have more, but 1,000 true fans is all you need. I always thought I'm the founder of this quote, but I actually think now he's the founder of this quote, which is better to be the only than the best. And we talk about that a little on this podcast. He always has such great advice and wisdom. He just wrote a book called Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I Had Known Earlier. And I would say a lot of the things in his wisdom is wisdom I had wished I'd known earlier. This is the third time he's been on the podcast. He's always so intriguing and interesting. And we talk about everything from the advice, practical applications of it. We talk about AI and what it's going to do to us. And I don't know, so many interesting things. I would listen to this podcast over and over again. I'm sending it to my kids. Here he is, Kevin Kelly.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Kevin, you look exactly the same as the last time you came on the podcast, which was about, I want to say, 5 years ago.
Probably even more than that. I would say it's probably at least 7 or 8 years ago. You look exactly the same, except you have more hair.
Yeah.
And I have less hair.
I have grayer hair and I have facial hair. So
and I have less hair.
Well, how have you been doing? I mean, obviously, I've read your book, Excellent Advice for Living, and there's so much I want to talk to you about, but how's it going?
It's going great. It really is fantastic. I'm having a ball and I am making art every day. That's a big thing.
What kind of art are you making?
Well, for a year, I posted something every day that I made by hand on an iPad. This year, I'm co-creating it with AI every day. So I have an assistant, an intern, and that intern is an intern and I are making art. And I'm trying to surprise myself. That's my main motivation in making art, is I have no idea what I'm going to do. I'm going to sit down and then I'm going to surprise myself with something. And so I kind of go where it leads me in the most surprising direction.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I'm a writer. I've written several books, and you've been a writer for decades. You've been an inspiration to all writers. And what's a way you've surprised yourself in writing?
Here's the thing about me and writing is I don't like to write. I like having written. And
I think that's true for every writer, by the way, because writing is very unnatural.
There are some. I worked at Wired and I hired, worked with writers like Neal Stephenson, who love to write. This is their relaxed state. They're just generating words and they just love that. I am the opposite, and the hardest thing for me is that first draft. And when I sit down, I don't sit down with ideas in my head that I have to get onto the page. I don't have any ideas. The ideas come to me through the act of writing. So writing is how I think, because I don't have the ideas before I sit down. So I sit down, and that act of forcing myself to put words on the page generates the ideas. And so when I'm sitting down, I'm surprised. It's like I didn't know that I thought that. And that's why I'm writing. I'm writing to figure out what I think.
What makes you sit down to write? Is it a deadline, or do you just do it?
I kind of need, well, both work. So I sometimes will take assignments and suggest things to Wired very kind of cautiously, because then I have a deadline and that will force me to produce stuff. So the common thing is I earlier days of AI and these image generators, I thought there's something really, really important here. I don't know what I think about it. I'll pitch a story to Wired. I'll get an assignment, and then I have to force myself to write it, and I'll conclude with knowing what I think about it. So I will sort of give myself a deadline in the sense of taking an assignment. Other times, like for my blog, I'll start to have an idea, and I'm saying, I think there's something there. I think it's important. And so I will give myself a kind of a mini deadline. I'm going to produce something today, and whatever, I'll write as much as I can figure out today. It's just a blog. And then I'll publish that. And so it's a way, it's how I think.
You know, you've written so many things that have become part of kind of the almost cultural identity, particularly of the tech world. Like, you know, still, I mean, I was just talking to you the other day, someone mentioned to me the concept of someone, there's this idea of 1,000 true fans. And I'm like, yeah,
yes.
Kevin Kelly has been on my podcast. But it's really true. I mean, there's entire industries now developed around marketing in terms of funneling a large audience down to the, you know, 1,000 true fans. And it works. If you have 1,000 true fans, those are the people who will make you a living, and because you're providing something of such incredible value to them. And your book, Excellent Advice for a Living, contains so many 1,000 true fans style pieces of advice. There's another thing. I think it's you who said, better to be the only than the best. Is that you?
Yeah, that's me. Well, again, I don't think I'm the first to say that, but I might be the first to say exactly this way, which is don't aim to be the best. Aim to be the only. And so that is sort of my, that's a bit of advice that I wished I had heard earlier in my life, because it would have really clarified things. And it took me kind of a long time to get there. And it was actually through Wired and trying to make writing assignments, as we were just talking about, to other writers that I came to this conclusion. And that was, you know, as an editor at Wired, we'd have story ideas. We'd try to find a writer to write the story. And I would pitch stories at these story meetings. And some of my ideas are like, no, that's not a good idea. Or, yeah, so what? And so I would say, okay, that's a stupid idea. Kill that one. But the idea would come back to me maybe a year later and say, you know, that I really like this idea. I think this is good. We should do this. And people would say, nah, I don't think so. It would get no votes. Okay, so kill that idea. And then maybe come back a third time. And you know, I really think this is a good idea, but no one else would think it's a good idea. And so then I had this realization, oh, I have to write this one. Because I'm the only one who thinks this is good. I'm probably the only one who can do it. I've been trying to give away the idea. No one else is going to do it. So I would do it, and that would be my best piece. And it was just like the idea of like, oh, that's why I'm here. And so a lot of people think that career-wise, that what you want to get to is a place where you're doing something that you love, you're doing something you're really good at, and you're doing something that other people find valuable to pay for you for. And that's the kind of holy trinity, that Venn diagram with those overlapping circles. Right. But there's a fourth state, and that fourth state is like, yeah, if those are kind of the minimum requirements, but it's also like, can anybody else do this? Can I outsource this? Is this something that someone else can do? Because then I'm not really the person who should be doing it. And so that's the question I ask these days, is not just, am I good at it? Would it be fun? Would I get paid for it? It's like, can anybody else do it? Because if someone else could do it, I want to give it to them, and I want to only wind up doing the things that only I can do. Because when I'm doing them, I don't have to worry about competitors. I've been trying to give away the idea. I don't have to look over my shoulder. I'm not in a hurry because no one else is going to do this. And it's easier. I'm going to be at ease with it because nobody else can do it. And so I'm aiming for those things, and I wish I was aiming for them when I was younger, where you're kind of like, it's the thing that you are doing, which, so you don't need a resume. So, you know, it could be your brand, all those kinds of things also put into play. And so that's one of the criteria that I use right now for deciding what to do next.
You know, there's so much to unpack in this. For one thing, it could be that you're the only, because quite correctly, everyone else refused to do it.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to be the only, you have to kind of experiment quite a bit to find the only that really stands out.
Yeah, you can't be the only sucker.
Right. Often that's happened to me where someone calls and says something like, oh, you've got to invest in this, where, I don't know, creating wireless all through Africa. And Bill Clinton's going to invest in the second round, but we're just closing the first round and we need you. And I start to, at first I'm excited, but then I start to think, is Bill Clinton really sitting by the phone waiting to find out if I've invested yet?
Right, exactly.
Like, that's not happening.
Right.
The other thing to unpack there is, like you mentioned, Neal Stephenson's a great writer and you're a great writer, but nobody can tell which writer is 10% better than another writer. But you can tell with like Neal Stephenson or William Gibson, oh, these guys invented an entire genre of writing. They're different. I don't know if Neal Stephenson is better than Ernest Hemingway. I have no clue. I can't, there's no metrics to judge. But I do know he did something really different from every other writer, including every other science fiction writer. And that's why we know Neal Stephenson.
Right, right. And so one of the downsides to chasing the best is that that's sort of an occupied, that's kind of usually occupied right now, niche. So if you want to become, you know, the world's best basketball player, it's great competition. I mean, it's intense competition. There's a very limited number of people in that movie. And so it's really hard. But what you want to be kind of is, you know, the best in something that there's probably no name for. And that's one of my bits of advice in the book for a young person is, or even for a startup or for a corporation or a company, which is try to work at in an area where there's no words, no name for what it is that you do. And where it takes a long time to kind of explain to your mother and father what it is that you're working on, because that is meaning that you're much more likely to kind of be in that territory of the only rather than the best. And you're much more likely to be able to be at an area where there's going to be a breakthrough, because that's where the breakthroughs happen. They break through that area where there's really no language right now.
There's a lot of ways to kind of figure out what is the only. And you mentioned in this book, being enthusiastic about something raises your IQ 25 points, which is really true, because your focus, if you're enthusiastic or obsessed, your focus while you're learning becomes so much more intense. You're going to learn, you're going to pick up so many more nuances than someone who's just not really that interested. And that's one way to be the only.
Right.
And it seems like another way to be the only is to be the best at an intersection of a bunch of areas.
Yeah.
So for instance, I'm never going to be Kevin Kelly you're never going to be the best basketball player in the world.
Right.
But you might be the best 68-year-old basketball player, or you might be the best combination of 68 years old basketball player, hockey player, and baseball player.
Right.
Like you get intersections.
Right. Or you could be something like the Globetrotters, which is you're a basketball comedian, you become, you know, the first basketball podcast announcer. Or I mean, there's just, you could combine, as you said, you could combine these. You could take a different tack. So, but the thing is that you want to drift towards something being the only. And there are basketball players who become the only in the sense of their style of play or whatever. But the point is that you want to kind of, if at all possible, define success your way. You kind of create your own definition of success. And if you are taking something, you know, an accountant or something off the shelf, that's so hard to really rise to the top because, as I said, everybody else, or there's millions of other people kind of on that same track. So find your own track. And that seems cliche, but it really does work. And by the way, this will take most of us, including me, most of our lives to kind of even head in that direction. You never really arrive. It's a direction rather than a destination. But kind of getting there it's a high bar. It's not easy. And the other thing I say about it is that you can't do this alone. It's really paradoxical that in order to be the most unique you need everybody else to help you. you need everyone else around you, your family, your friends, your acquaintances, colleagues, clients, and customers to kind of help you see who you should become or are becoming and become the only. That's a collective effort in order to make a unique individual.
I mean, I sort of look at you and I see you're the only in terms of you've really stood out as a source of wisdom, particularly in the tech world for decades, not just like last year or this year, or you have something to say about AI, but for decades, you've been kind of preaching this message that goes beyond what's the latest Apple earnings, what's my review of the latest product, and so on. You really kind of try to determine what peak performance is in this arena. But let me ask you, what if the people around you didn't support you? What if your wife or kids or colleagues weren't really big. You realized all of a sudden they weren't fans of the Kevin Kelly you were becoming.
Right, right. So that's a really fair question. And I would say there's another piece of advice, like, you know, to get rich, you want to try and succeed. To get really wealthy, you want to help other people succeed. And so one of the things I would say to do is to kind of, your job becomes to help the people around you help you. And how do you help other people around you to help you is you want to help them to succeed. And as they succeed, they are more capable of helping you succeed.
That is a really powerful advice, actually.
Yeah. So you're going to say, so it's like, yeah, you're not really supporting me, but I'm going to support you. And this comes back to the kind of the weirdest paradox in the universe, which is fundamentally at its core, which is the more you give, the more you get. I mean, this mathematically makes no sense at all, right? That the more you give away, the more you get. It's someone recently said, like, the most selfish thing you can do is to give things away. Right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all, but that is just sort of so fundamental. And so that's what you begin to do with the people around you is you start to give to them, and then they are able to, they'll send it back to you to help you find your way.
It's so interesting because having experienced many ups and downs over the past few decades, as I'm sure you have as well, I find when I'm most down, at a down point, it's really hard to think about helping others because you're so consumed with the potential disasters in your mind.
Right. And that's, but you know that when you do, it returns, yields, unbelievable yields. And so, and that's usually the turning point for most people is turning from that inward focus to outward. And the moment that happens, things begin to change. And so it's hard, as you said, if you're hurting, you're in pain, suffering, those tend to bring your mind inward and it becomes difficult to do it. But when you're capable, when you're able to, for those moments, you can see that that's the solution, is to flip it around.
What's an example from your life?
I learned some of these things hitchhiking, where even though I'm asking for a favor, it's really about the other person picking up. They're after something. They're looking for it. And so I turn hitchhiking around. It's like, I'm giving you an opportunity. I'm giving you an opportunity to have a conversation. I want to listen to you. I'm going to listen to you. You can listen to me. I'll tell you a story. And then I'm being vulnerable because I'm out there saying, yeah, I'm alone. Here is, you can pick me up. Who knows what will happen. But I'm going to receive. I'm going to receive from you. I'm going to receive your gift of a ride, and in return, we'll share something. And so there was this. I mean, believe it or not, hitchhiking is sort of is very outward focus in a weird sort of way. We did that enough to see the power of, like, being vulnerable, of being able to receive things, of being able to kind of give in reciprocation to people that I would normally not even interact with or not even like, whatever it is. That was something that taught me about this sort of flipping things around.
You just brought back a wave of memories of when I was younger, and I used to hitchhike quite a bit in the city I lived in. In fact, I used to race my friends. I would bet them I can get to someplace faster by hitchhiking. But you're right. Someone picks you up because for a few minutes they want a friend.
Yeah.
And the one piece of advice I always give people who hitchhike is, make sure you don't slam the door. Everybody hates when you slam the door.
Yeah, I used to hitchhike to work every day. It was so reliable. And
I hitchhiked away from work.
And my piece of advice about hitchhiking is look like the kind of people that you want you to pick up, that you want to pick you up. So, like, you know,
that's in your book.
Like, yeah, mirror their look. I haven't yet. Well, there was a guy who was hitchhiking in a suit, which I thought was just totally brilliant. I haven't quite done that yet. Yeah, I think a theme that runs through my book, and by the way, that is more of me as an only, is I've become deliberately more optimistic as I get older, more and more optimistic. That is what runs through the book, is a sense of optimism and generosity.
Yeah.
I think those are very, very related. as kind of the foundational stance that I've come to not believe the story that we tell ourselves that the basic human instinct is selfishness. I think it's the opposite. I think the basic human instinct, when all things are equal, is to share, is to help. And I've just seen that around the world, and that's just how the world works. And if you trust strangers, I think that is my default, is I am going to, haven't met you before, but I'm going to totally trust you unless you give me evidence otherwise, as the default. And occasionally, sure, I may get cheated because of that trust, but I consider that a tax on the incredible benefits I get by trusting strangers, because they give me their best when I trust them. And so compared to the benefits that you'll get when you trust others, getting cheated every now and then is just a little tiny tax that I willingly pay.
You know, a lot of this advice, like take the advice about hitchhiking. This applies really to more than just hitchhiking. Hitchhiking is almost a metaphor. Like if you're trying to sell your company, even if you're talking about billions of dollars of value, ultimately someone wants to buy your company because they want you as a friend closer to them.
Yes.
They want you in the office next to them so they can hang out with you.
Yes. It's very, very human, very social. And that's something else that I kind of, you know, being involved in some startups and my own business over time is that I've come really to see that businesses are extensions of the personalities of the founders. I mean, they're a way to kind of amplify their personality, and they do amplify their personality. And that's why I have another bit of advice, which is don't ever work for somebody that you don't want to become, right? Because you will. If you're working for someone that kind of a founder that has this vision, and it's someone you don't want to be, it's like, don't work for them, because you are kind of participating in their expression, and you'll become more like them as you work around people. So you do want to choose when you have a choice. Family, you don't have a choice. But where you work and colleagues, these are under your control, and you want to associate yourself with people who help you on your path to being the only.
You mentioned in the book, most overnight successes take at least 5 years. And I agree with that. Can you outline a little bit those 5 years? Like, what's year one look like? What's year two look like? And so on.
Yeah. And by the way, that's one way that I kind of do my life accounting, meaning like, okay, I am 71. You know, at the very, very best, you know, let's say I can make it to 100. So that's 30 years. And so that's I have six more projects I can do in my life at the best. And that's assuming that I can do any kind of project from between 95 and 100. But and you can count them off. And that's a really good way to kind of think about your life. You know, I have this countdown clock that Matt Groening used in Futurama on my computer about how many days I have left. What it took was the actuarial tables for someone born my age and male, et cetera, in America, and statistically my lifespan left, and turned it into days, and then put it into a clock, which shows up. It says, okay, I have 5,862 days left. And man, that is really, really sobering and clarifying. So I like to think in terms of days and five-year blocks. So I have, you know, 5,000 something days to do whatever I'm going to do. And the five-year things, because and there's 5 years. And so the 5 years is an accounted from the moment you first have the idea and maybe sketching it and making notebook ideas to the day that you stop thinking about it. That's the limits. And so the first initial part of it is just kind of noodling, thinking, trying to decide whether this is a good idea, whether you really want to do it, what the consequences would be, maybe trying to imagine it. And I believe, and that's another piece of advice in the book, in prototyping. Prototype your life instead of making grand plans. Prototype everything. So this is the book. And I made prototype versions of the book that are bound and different versions of it as I went along imagining and designing the book. And I do that with all my books at different stages, make prototypes. And I do that with anything I make or design. Is like in the kitchen remodel, we did a prototype of full-scale cardboard. You know, get refrigerator cardboards, boxes, and you make a full-scale prototype of it to see what it looks like in real life, to see what it feels like, so you can make those adjustments. And when I make things, I make a prototype version of it, knowing that I'm going to throw it away. In other words, there's just a step on the way. And so that's for me the second year, kind of, is, or at least the second latter half of the first year is prototyping stage, where I'm kind of still exploring. I can tell really whether it's going to work or not, and still trying to see whether I'm committing to it or not. And then once I'm going further, I'll prototype again the next stages, maybe to see whether there's more people that want to be involved, whether it's what the scale of this thing is, take kind of the next step. I usually try to have one person involved because I find that it helps me move things forward. It's like there's kind of accountability maybe a little bit in that.
So like with this book, did you have like an editor you would throw ideas against or?
Yeah. I had an early reader, Hugh Howey.
Oh, I love Hugh.
Hugh is great. And so Hugh was kind of urging on, and he was giving advice, and I was sharing things with him. And yeah, I mean, he gets a little credit in the book because he was that accountability kind of factor. And
how did you meet Hugh, by the way? But by the way, shout out to Hugh Howey, May 5th. I'm so looking forward to the science fiction series,
yes.
Silo coming out on Apple Plus, based on his great series of self-published novels called Wool. Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic writer.
Yeah. Yeah. And Hugh has a fantastic story about how he was, you know, working in a bookstore and, you know, made his success by writing chapters and publishing them on Amazon singles, self-publishing. So I met Hugh, I think, at maybe a Ted Banff gathering. He was there. Hugh is really good at becoming friends to everybody, right? Once you know Hugh, he's your lifelong friend, and he's really good and really works hard at being a friend. So I met him briefly, and, you know, we've been friends. We've done some great walks together, comes by, stays at our house. So it's really... I would give it all to Hugh, who is just a fantastic professional friend in many ways, because I know that he has lots of friends throughout the world, because he really works at it. He takes it very seriously. And I think that's another skill that you can have, is the skill of being a friend.
I feel like I need to be better at that skill. I feel like it's very hard for me to keep in touch with people.
Why is that?
I don't know. I get just caught up in my own activities, and then I just don't call people to say, hey, how are you doing?
Right.
And I agree with the advice in your book. Like, I'm never very transactional either. Like, I really like being friends with people, and I'm not transactional, but it's just hard for me to pick up the phone and check in with people.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm doing, taking my own advice, is that, I advise don't withhold your praise and compliments to someone until their eulogy, until they're gone. It's always really bizarre. You know, people say the most fantastic things about people at their funeral. It's like, why don't we say those things to their, while they're alive, when they can enjoy it?
Well, usually because they're lying at the funeral, but setting that aside.
No, I don't think so.
but actually, yeah, you have as advice in the book, to earn bliss for just a moment, find someone you barely know or don't know and give them a compliment.
Yeah, or thank a teacher that helped you. Yes, that is true. And the other piece of advice is you should attend as many funerals as you can and listen to what people say, because, and I unfortunately have that opportunity more and more often these days as I get older. But if you listen to what people say, they almost never talk about that person's achievements. What they talk about is how that person made them feel, what kind of a person they were while they were achieving, what they were about. And that's very sobering. It's very, very sobering. So I try to keep that in mind with people, and not just asking how they're doing, but seeing if I could be of help. There's a great piece of advice for our kids, which is, instead of asking them, what did you learn today at school? You say, who did you help today at school?
Yeah, I like that. Now, you know, speaking of kids, you said in part the inspiration for writing this book was you're writing advice to your children. Yeah. And you wrote 68 pieces of advice, and they wanted much more. Yeah. So you ended up writing 450 pieces of advice.
Yeah.
Do you think they follow your advice?
Well, I have three kids, and they're now young adults. We were the opposite of helicopter parents. I don't know what the opposite is. It's like not feral. We were not absent, but we really did not give them a lot of advice. Because I think the kids don't listen to what parents say. They just watch what you do. So we tried to give our advice by modeling it. And so I asked my son after I gave him the copy of the book just the other day. And he said, yeah, I have never heard you say these things, but you did teach them to us. And I thought, okay, that worked. And you know, there's a very trivial example. So neither my wife or I swear. That's just sort of how we were. We just never swear. We never had a single conversation about swearing in our family. Never once was there anything about this is what we say, don't say, this is language. Even talked about it. There was never, it was simply never a topic. But none of my kids swear. Huh. You know, I didn't ever say, well, you've got to be careful about this or I care about it. There was just simply, but they were just modeling that behavior.
I think this is a very important thing for parents to hear. Like, for me, whenever I've told my kids, you have to do this, this is the right way, and it's because of X, Y, Z, like, I might be right, but they're just going to walk away and not listen to me.
Yeah,
like, you really have to live what you say.
If you say no phones at the table, but you have your phone, that this doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
So, we don't have phones or screens at tables, but we've never said you can't have it. It's just that we don't have them. They don't have them. Everybody leaves them away. So that's modeling the behavior is sort of how we did it. But having said that, I did like the fact that they're written down because I found it helpful. And that's why I wrote them down originally was I think having this condensed version of them. So I spent most of my time trying to reduce these to a little tiny encapsulated tweet size thing that you could repeat to yourself and that I could repeat to myself. So like a bit of advice, a practical advice is that if I lost something in my household and I can't remember where it is and I eventually find it, then when I'm putting it back, I repeat to myself, don't put it back where I found it, put it back where I first looked for it.
And that's just
that really works. Put it back where you first looked for it. And so that is changing my behavior. And so because I can repeat that. Or another piece is like, you know, if I'm invited to do something in 6 months from now, I always ask myself, would I do this if it was tomorrow morning? Huh. All right. Would I do this if it was tomorrow morning?
What's an example of something where you said no to?
Oh, all the time. I get invited every other day to speak somewhere. And so I'm trying to decide, okay, would I learn anything from this? You know, what's the situation? How much trouble it is? And I literally ask myself, would I want to get on a plane tomorrow morning and do this? And so I generally say no because I think I really don't want to do it tomorrow morning.
I need to learn this as well. Like, I think when something's like a couple of months away, I almost always, and it seems exciting, I almost always say yes. And then as it gets closer, I'm like,
morning. Would I say yes to it? It really works.
Tell me about the rule of three in conversation. Yeah. You write about this in the book. I found this fascinating.
There's two rules of three, but the rule of three in conversation is, and this came from Esther Perel, the legendary marriage counselor, which is that when you're having an intimate conversation and you're trying to kind of get to the bottom of something, you have to ask why or what's the story or what do you feel about it at three rounds. So the first round of like, you know, tell me what's going on, whatever it is kind of like it's like the cover story. And then you say, well, you know, tell me what you really feel or what's really behind that or why you're doing that. Why? Because of the first one. And you hear another explanation, another level of intimacy. But you really need to stick around and press for the third level like, okay, really, like, you know, I get that. That's why you're doing it. But tell me more. And when you get to the third level, that's very, very close to what the actual truth about the situation is.
Can you give me an example?
Well, if somebody you know and love maybe is angry at you or something, and you can say, you know, what's going on, and there'll be some explanation about maybe something at work or whatever it is, but then you kind of go further and it find out that it's maybe something that there are that there's maybe a physical thing that's also prompting this, that there's some level of a hurt or, you know, haven't been sleeping or couldn't sleep last night or last two nights. And then there's, if you press on it, there's a third level of maybe a deeper anxiety that's, you know, behind the insomnia that's fundamentally worrying, that's more crucial to the core of the person's being. And that's usually kind of embarrassing to say initially on the first round. So you have to kind of go through the process. In a certain sense, you have to earn a kind of a trust to be able to hear that true inner story.
I always say there's always a good reason and a real reason.
Yeah.
Related to your rule of three, the good reason is sort of just the cover story. Like I always give as an example, my daughter saying she wants to go to the library to study. So that's a good reason. But the real reason might be there's boys at the library.
Right. Or she wants to get away from you guys.
Yeah, exactly. That's the other real reason. Right. I love this one, and I never really thought about this. And at any given point, we're always involved in different negotiations in our life. And you say the four most powerful words in any negotiation is, can you do better? And I wonder, like, let's say, you know, you're applying for a job, you get a job, the boss offers you a salary, and there, he has this big HR handbook, and this is the salaries for someone entering in at this level. So he makes it seem like there's a formula. That's often also a powerful negotiating technique, is to say, I can't do anything about it. It's the formula.
Yeah.
When does can you do better than other times?
Everybody knows that even in situations where there's a handbook and stuff, they actually can negotiate. I mean, that's the truth, is that if they want you bad enough, there is some room for negotiation all the time. But obviously, it works best when there aren't those kind of rules, and where there's not a lot of comps, there's not a lot of comparables, from houses to buying parts to all kinds of things. I would say that the default is most of the times there is some wiggle room, and it may not be very much. But as you said, can you do better? And usually the answer is yes. But it may not be very much. And those who are really good, and I don't consider myself the ace negotiator, but those who are really good go through life and they, you know, you accumulate those little bits of differences, and they can make a difference in aggregate.
Yeah.
And, you know, even like, and it's really well known that all kinds of services, from your, how much you pay for your phone to, you know, your Comcast to insurance, there's actually far more room for negotiation than appears to most people. Most of us don't even bother with it because it is kind of a hassle to get into that negotiation. But even those kind of off-the-shelf sticker prices are usually, there's negotiations in them.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. There's multiple dimensions in negotiating. So it's not just always about money.
Right.
Can you do better? It might be about benefits or vacation or something you haven't even
thought of. There was a pretty well-known, I think it's either This American Life or Radio Lab, I think it was This American Life's episode on the good guy discount. Have you ever heard about that?
Yeah.
Well, apparently, particularly in kind of the retail stores, there was this thing called the good guy discount that all you had to do was ask for the good guy discount, and they would immediately give you like 10%. And so they were going around just trying that, just kind of walking into stores, buying a t-shirt or something and asking for the good guy discount. And like some percentage of it, maybe a third of the time, they were given the 10% discount. It was like, what? It's like just because they asked for it. And so, yeah, I mean, I remember negotiating even at my local, when I was a kid in high school, my little place where you buy the blue jeans. And there was like, I found a kind of pair of Levi's or whatever with the right size and the right instrument because I'm kind of very short legs. And I bought, I said, I'd like to buy four of these now because like for like future, you know, and can you give me a discount? You know, like, can you do better? And even though they were, you know, they were marked, labeled, the price tag, they negotiated. They gave me a bar.
Wow. And so, you know, earlier you referred to that you're doing art and with the, often with the assistance of AI. And on the whole, I'm very optimistic about AI and its potential for the economy and productivity and our artistry and so on. But as a writer, I sometimes wonder, will AI learn enough about me, my style, better than me? And this is related to don't be the best, be the only. How can one make sure they're the only, no matter how much AI improves?
Right. So I have a recent bit of advice, which is, I think a worthy aim in life is to try to become less predictable to such an extent that AI won't be able to predict you and therefore replace you.
I like that.
I mean, that's what AIs are these days. They're basically autocomplete engines that are predicting the next word based on all the human, average human responses in the world. And so they're what I call the universal personal intern because they're trained on the average of all human input and they make kind of the average human output. And you have to really kind of work with your digital intern to get them beyond that kind of mediocre middle. And that's what I think we're going to be doing with them. It's not that they, I have lots to say about the AI, but what they can't, there's lots of things they can't do even now based on the way that they're currently built. But what they're really good at in terms of becoming the only is that they think differently than humans. They don't think like humans. The AI that they, art that they make is weirdly little off. The stuff that they write, even though it's kind of like, when it's predictably human, is human average and not very useful if you want to become the owner because it's like it's the average of what everybody would say. And if you nudge them and trying to get them and work with them to get them off of that average, they tend to go in kind of ways that no human would go. And that's actually, in my eyes, their benefit, their chief attribute is because they aren't like humans. And that we'll use them to help us think differently. So that's how people are using them nowadays is they generate some concepts. It's like, no human would ever think of that. It's kind of weirdly inhuman. And it's alien. That's what I call it, the artificial aliens. And so that alienness is actually what we can use for ourselves as we make art to try and move us in the kind of directions that we would not normally get to. And then we can try to make it our own. The reason why there was always going to be something, at least for this first generation, that they can't do is that I discovered this by trying to make art with them. There's a whole bunch of art that they can't get to. So theoretically, these engines can make any possible picture. That's, you know, the possibility space of images is huge and they can generate basically any possible image, but they can't get to them because they have a language interface. That's the big news with the AI. It's not their ability to make images. They can do that for years, but now we have a conversational user interface. We have this conversational interface with them. That's the big bang that everybody's going crazy over is that you have a conversational interface to all kinds of things now, including images. But what it means is that they can only make images that can be described in language. And there's so much of human art that we make and the art that I've been trying to make that cannot be reduced to words. There's no words that are going to get there. There's no description in language to get there. And because there isn't, these models can't make it. I've been trying to get them to make this kind of art, but I can't put it into words. And so therefore, these image makers can't make it. And so there's lots that we do. Music is one of them. They'll have AI generating music, but a lot of music cannot be described in words. It's ephemeral. That's the whole point of it. And so we might continue to evolve new interfaces, or maybe more musical acoustic ways to work with it. But still, there's parts of it that they cannot reach because the interface doesn't allow them to reach it. And so we are still going to be involved. And I think the major stance and relationship that we want to have and understand with these artificial aliens is as partners. For the most part, most of the time, we're going to be partnering with them to curate stuff. They're not going to replace us. There are partners. They need us. We need them. It's like in doctoring and medicine. You know, yes, right now, almost any human doctor is going to be better than an AI doctor. However, a human and AI team is better than both the AI by itself and the doctor by itself. And lastly, an AI doctor, not as good as a human doctor, but even an AI doctor alone is better than no doctor, which is what most of the people in the world have.
You know, it's interesting. You bring up music and they can't understand, let's say, the text to describe music. But if they're learning on, let's say, Mozart sonatas,
right,
the language of notes and chords and so on, they can learn from that. And so now AI can make a Mozart sonata that experts can't tell is not a Mozart sonata.
Sure. And so if you want to make more Mozarts, yes, you can do that. That gets very boring after a while. But if you want to make new music that you want to listen to, they could, in theory, generate the music, but they're not going to arrive there because there's no, I mean, how do we tell them to get there? How do we tell them to do something? How do we correct it? So if they just do some random thing, anything done at random is going to be almost improbably worthless, right? Statistically, if you take a randomly generated book, it's going to be nonsense. And so the issue is, yes, they in theory could make any string of notes, but to work with them, to get them to go somewhere that's really beautiful that we haven't been to, there's no interface for that because, right, I mean, other than language or some earlier prompt of existing music, they can do something in between, but how do you get them to fine-tune it if you don't have a way to interface? So that's where we are. I think it's the first generation. It may be that as we go further, we can have better ways to interface them, but that is the thing is that we have intuition and all kinds of other things that are transcend language as a means of what we're trying to do, emotions, of course, and other things. But we don't, the AIs are ignorant of that in a certain sense. They aren't capable of that transcendent ability yet. And so for the time around, we are going to work with them to produce something the equivalent of Mozart. They need us, we need them to get there.
You know, you mentioned earlier that as you get older, you've gotten more optimistic.
Yeah.
And with myself, I feel particularly recently, I've gotten a bit more pessimistic. Like things are a little bit more, even though, you know, as Mark Twain says, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And so you can say, okay, this has happened more or less before. I feel like things are more uncertain now.
Yeah.
Than ever before.
Yes.
And that scares me a little bit.
Yes.
Even though I know things have been worse before, like, you know, we've had Vietnam, we've had the Civil War, we've had, you know, horrible things happen around the world and in this country and to ourselves personally. But lately, somehow the uncertainty has unnerved me.
Yeah.
What's your source of, what are you optimistic about now?
So you're right. First of all, I think that is, I was just having this conversation yesterday with somebody who's pretty high up in the tech stack, we might say. And there is a sense in which there is, I would say, greater uncertainty. And you know, just because of the speed at which things are moving, the way that we're moving into new territory, there is a sense in which, you know, we really haven't been here before. This is really new territory. And that is an uncertainty. And then you have the speed of change that kind of like saying, well, what I used to know may not really apply. I'm not really sure if it does. So how can I be optimistic in this? Well, I think a couple sources of my optimism. One is a sense of history. The more I think about the future, the more I read about history, the more I know about the history, the more I'm convinced that progress is real, right? So progress is real, and all the ingredients that we have for progress are still present. So statistically, it's going to continue. The progress will continue. It could stop tomorrow, but it's just unlikely to, because all the ingredients for progress in the past are still present going forward. So progress, and that's again a global average. That's a sort of on average. Doesn't mean that everywhere. There's obviously places in the world like Ukraine that's probably going to have a really, really couple of bad years coming up. You know, it's like, yeah, can't be optimistic about that. And so the second source of my optimism is going back to this idea of trusting strangers. And I think what optimism you're doing is you're kind of you're trusting the future. You're trusting that it's not that our problems are fewer and smaller than we think they are. It's that our capacity to solve problems is greater than we thought, and probably in increasing faster than our abilities to make problems. So if we can create 1% more than we destroy every year, that 1% difference, even if it's a 0.5% difference, is compounded over time. And that's sort of where the optimism comes, is that we can compounded interest, compounded benefits. So even a tiny 1%, 0.5% difference, which is not visible, you can't see it. You look around and you see all this crap and terrible and harm and stuff. But all we need is 1% more good than bad. And that 1% is sufficient over time. So yeah, I can easily agree to the huge amount of terrible stuff in the world, but all I need is 1% more good, and I can be optimistic.
Yeah, I guess that's interesting. And I wonder, because on the one hand, you see all the progress in biotech, genomics, alternative energy, AI, robotics, and on, I could go on and on. And I wonder if it gets disconnected from, at least in my head, from, oh, they're going to raise interest rates so high that everybody's going to go broke, there's going to be a depression, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how to connect the two like I normally would.
Yeah. It's, you know, if one thing is that bad news happens faster than good news. The bad happens fast. Good takes time. And another way to be optimistic, another reason I'm optimistic is taking the long view, either in the past as well as the future. But by nature, media news is about bad stuff, because that's what happens on the short term, is mostly bad. Good stuff takes a longer time to happen. So if the headlines, if you only read headlines or make headlines every 100 years instead of the last 5 minutes, the headlines would be completely different. They'd all be good news, you know? Lifespan's up, security increases, violent deaths are decreasing. And so the nature of news in general, no matter where it's sourced, is that it's going to report on the bad thing that's happened in the last 12 hours, because the good stuff doesn't happen at that speed. And so as you take a longer and longer view, if you start to think generationally about how to be a good ancestor, and you elevate it, that elevated horizon can accommodate all kinds of fairly major setbacks and disasters, because in the longer term, they don't matter as much. They can be the good compounding good of a few percent a year can actually overcome those kinds of setbacks.
I love the advice in your book, to be a good ancestor, plant a tree.
Yeah. That's one of the
easiest things to do. That exemplifies what you're saying. Like, a tree will ultimately be a huge part of any ecosystem,
right?
But it takes a long time. It's not going to make a headline, Kevin Kelly planted a tree.
Right. So yeah. So when I when I was 17, I lived, I grew up in New Jersey, and I back here.
Where in New Jersey?
In Westfield, New Jersey, and I planted a seedling, a little seedling that had sprouted from the acorn. The acorn was still attached to it, and I planted it in our backyard. And I said, I want to come back here in 50 years and see a big tree. And I had my 50th high school reunion last year, and I went back and the tree was there, and it was a huge 100-foot oak tree that I planted when I was 17.
Wow. 100 foot.
It was just, yes, it was beautiful. And you know, the old saying, the best time to plant a tree was 50 years ago. The second best time is today. So we want to think generationally. And when you do that, you can become more optimistic. And that forces, yeah, and that's true. And thinking about the future and trying to make a future that we want to live in requires us to imagine it. It's not going to happen accidentally, inadvertently. We're not going to have a great set of technologies that work in the future and a kind of a social system accidentally. We have to kind of imagine it first. And the future is built by people who believe that it's possible to make it. And that act of optimism means that, you know, the future is into present is actually shaped by optimists.
What else happened at your 50th high school reunion? Like, were you glad you went? What did you learn?
So, the surprise to me, and this was a self-selected set of people, but surprise to me was the number of people who had never left the area. Because, of course, that is self-selecting because they're more likely to come to the reunion. So that was one thing. And the other thing, the thing that I did, I gave myself a little of an assignment. It says, I had a class of almost 1,000. I want to talk to all the people, all the kids that I never spoke to in my class. And I didn't even know were in my class. And so that was my assignment, was not talking to my close friends, but to kind of meet classmates that I went through high school with and never once had a conversation with. And that was great because there were a bunch of people who went very different paths than I do. You know, I graduated in 1970. There was a guy who joined the military, joined the army voluntarily. It's like, what? This is like Vietnam War is going on. It's crazy. Anyway, his life was very, you know, it was very interesting. He eventually became a pilot and then a traffic controller, and it's like there was an entire world that I didn't know anything about. So for me, that was the joy.
And that's, you know, just in general, I find you're a very curious person. You learn, it seems like you try to learn from everybody and every experience around you. And I really admire that. I try to do that myself, but you're very successful at that. And, you know, one thing you say, and I think this is one of the most powerful pieces of advice you have, is when someone is nasty or mean to you, assume they have a disease.
Yeah. Treat it as if it was a disease is how I say it.
Right, because it allows you to have sympathy instead of anger for them.
Just assume that there's a little bit like, well, maybe they can't help it. There's some reason for it there. If I sat down, maybe I'd understand it and it'd be kind of like not justified, but at least understandable. And so I find that easier to say, well, somebody's kind of really, really nasty. It's like, oh, they have a brain tumor. You know, it's like, because actually that happened. That was based on something that happened when I was in high school. Was a girl in my class, her dad became really, really terrible. And then he suddenly died, and the autopsy discovered he had this really huge brain tumor. It was like, okay. What if we all knew that? We would have been a little bit more forgiving, you know, working with that. That would have been a huge difference. And so now I'll kind of go forward and say, yeah, you know, they have a brain tumor.
But let me ask you a question. Like, you're such a revered person in you know, anybody who knows you and anybody who knows your work. When was the last time someone was nasty to you? Someone you knew?
Someone that I knew. Okay. I have a relative who got very, very upset. I mean, it's a very complicated story. Very, very angry at me for something that I was trying to do in their lives. And so we, you know, we had a cooling off period that helped a lot. And I treated it as if something, that there was a reason, that there was a reason behind it that I didn't know about, that I'm going to assume I'll find out later. And the answer was to cool down. And then I saw him recently and it was perfectly fine. He was in much better spirits. The thing that was causing this kind of conflict hadn't really been resolved, but it had been, what's the word I want, accommodated. So rather than kind of escalating things, yeah, we kind of like, how do you de-escalate it? And there was a little bit of kind of like trying to empathy. It's a form of empathy, really, of you're trying to say, well, I don't even know what it is, but I know that there's probably, again, we didn't have that three-level conversation. That would have been really good, but that was something that was not going to happen at that time. So I just assumed that if we got down to the third level, that there would be something that would be helpful.
That's a good piece of advice, too, to assume there's a third level.
Right.
Like, basically, every mine has gold at the bottom in there somewhere. Right.
So one of the pieces of advice is I think that we only see 2% of the other person, and they only see 2% of us. And you have to kind of just account for the fact that there's 98% of something going on that you're not aware of. And
yeah,
that's just my default stance is like, yeah, you know, there's James, you see 2% of me and there's 98% that you're not seeing that's going on behind me, whatever it is. And that's just my assumption. And so you have kind of a calculate in that form.
Well, for part of the other 98%, though, we do have your book, Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier, which is an important subtitle, by the way, because everybody says, oh, I never regret anything. I do believe in regrets, and I wish I had some more wisdom when I was younger. But thankfully now I have your book, Excellent Advice for Living. And by the way, just general advice books are usually pretty bad.
Yeah.
But your advice is, as you could point out, is generational. Like your 1,000 true fans that advice is gonna live forever. Your don't be the best, be the only. This is gonna live forever. So much of your advice in this book. I mean, I started just bookmarking almost every page, but it's a beautiful book. It's beautiful advice. It's really worth thinking about. And I super enjoyed this conversation. It's almost like I treated this as a private therapy conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I really enjoyed our conversation and we're having so much fun that I realized that I actually overstayed my time and I have to run right now to my next one.
I did want to ask you advice, but I'll do it some other time.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. I really had a blast as usual.
Yeah. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks so much for coming back on.